The following is taken from the Institute for Historical Review and can be seen here. Fred A. Lauster is America's leading specialist on the design and fabrication of execution equipment, including homicidal gas chambers. In 1988, Lauster scraped samples from the alleged gas chamber walls in Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Lublin. Cyanide residue would be clearly evident on all these walls if gassings did occur. To his astonishment, Lauster found no significant cyanide traces in any one of these rooms. In 1991, the Polish government repeated these tests to disprove Lauster's findings, but they as well found no evidence of any gassings ever occurring. The structural integrity of these gas chambers is also extremely faulty. These rooms have ordinary doors and windows which are not hermetically sealed. There are large gaps between the floors and doors. If the Germans had attempted to gas anyone in these rooms, they would have died themselves, as the gas would have leaked and contaminated the entire area. Also, no equipment exists to exhaust the air-gas mixture from these buildings. Nothing was made to introduce or distribute the gas throughout the chambers. There are no provisions to prevent condensation of gas on the walls, floors, or ceiling. And no exhaust stacks have ever existed. Though 6 million Jews supposedly died in the gas chambers, not one body has ever been autopsied and found to have died of gas poisoning. We have been shown piles of bodies from World War II, but most of these persons died of typhus or starvation, according to Red Cross records, or Allied bombings, and a great many of those were murdered Germans, not Jews. Roughly, the equivalent of 10 football fields should be packed full of gassed bodies to present as evidence, yet not one body has ever been discovered. The Germans documented everything in meticulous detail from shrubbery to arbors, but no pre-war or wartime plans or documents exist that detail or even mention any gas chambers for reasons of genocide. All documents ever presented are drawn up after the war. Even if we threw away all this evidence and accounted for every so-called gas chamber, it would have taken 68 years to accomplish gassing 6 million Jews. Even the diary of Anne Frank is a hoax. Portions of the diary were written with a ballpoint pen. These pens were not in use at the time Anne Frank lived. There are compelling reasons to believe that the so-called Holocaust never existed. Page 223 in The Diary of Anne Frank, Pan Horizons Edition, Pan Books Limited, London, 1989, indicates that the size of Auschwitz, the most notorious of all German work camps, was very small, with only 11,000 people, many of whom may not even have been Jews, being evacuated by the Germans at the time of the Russian advance in 1945. Certainly, compared to Spielberg's film Schindler's List, which Emil Schindler, Oscar's widow, said was full of lies, and other Jewish propaganda that millions upon millions of Jews were systematically exterminated, 11,000 people is a very small number. Simple arithmetic tells us that the Germans would have had to have had hundreds of camps, or else they would have had to exterminate 137 people per hour, 24 hours a day, in order for 6 million Jews to have been exterminated at such small camps in Auschwitz, a feat that would have been humanly impossible considering that, according to Douglas Reed's Behind the Scene and Controversy of Zion, a mere 850,000 soldiers and others were killed by the entire German and Japanese war machines combined during World War II. From page 397 through 400 of Douglas Reed's book, Controversy of Zion. People who would believe the Jewish propaganda that 6 million Jews were exterminated by Hitler must keep in mind the small-scale construction of Auschwitz and the very few other German work camps that existed during World War II. On July 13, 1994, a documentary on the life of Charles A. Lindbergh, broadcast on the public broadcast system, PBS, KENW-TV, said that when Lindbergh visited one of these few camps in Germany following World War II, he was told that 25,000 died in 1.5 years. Again, simple arithmetic tells us that 25,000 times a half dozen camps does not equal 6 million. In fact, it doesn't even equal 600,000. It is an interesting fact that the number of so-called persecuted Jews keeps increasing. Hal Greenwald, program director for the Hillel Foundation at Duke University, a Jewish student group, has been promoting the idea that 9 million Jews were exterminated in Hitler's gas chambers. New York Times, November 9, 1991, Associated Press. Now it's 9 million and growing. Just like our debt tax money supply, the numbers just keep coming out of thin air. It is not denied concentration camps existed. Tragically, many died of typhus or starvation, as often happens in such situations. There is, however, no evidence that any gassings occurred for the reasons of genocide. End excerpt. If the Holocaust story is true, why have the Zionist Jews enacted laws against Holocaust denial around the world, and why are people arrested and imprisoned for questioning the Holocaust in almost every country? To put this into perspective, imagine if there were laws against 9/11 denial, and it was against the law for us in groups like We Are Changed to protest and hold up signs or banners, or to even discuss 9/11. All I can say is that if I had a labor camp that was building and supplying my war effort, I would not be killing my laborers and treating them poorly as is portrayed in the Hollywood Holocaust. History is continuously showing that the Hollywood portrayal of slaves in ancient civilizations such as Egypt, where slaves built the pyramids, has been completely misrepresented. In actuality, the pharaohs provided many amenities and services to their slaves, like oils, bountiful foodstuffs, and more than adequate shelter. It just doesn't make sense to commit genocide against the people you absolutely need, nor does it make sense that the Germans would arbitrarily kill the Jews at the same time that they were in an agreement with Zionist world Judaism to export them. And finally, America didn't rush in to save anyone else during the Bolshevik Revolution, so why the sudden change of heart for the poor suffering Jews in Germany? I can only hope that those reading or listening to this can think for themselves and haven't been so dumbed down that the truth is not attainable through logic and reason and proof. One more thing. This is an essay about the American prison and labor camps which were set up for German prisoners by the USA, the French, etc. It is an accounting by a young American soldier who stood guard at these camps which housed German farmers and citizens. They were in open fields with no shelter, surrounded by barbed wire. They were starved, they slept in the mud, and they were shot for target practice. The victorious always become the tyrants, even us, or in my opinion, especially us. These atrocities are human and not race-driven. Power corrupts anyone, even against their will, and we obey orders or face punishment, kind of like why we still pay taxes. This essay was published in the Journal of Historical Review, Summer 1990, Volume 10, Number 2, pages 161 through 166, revised, updated November 2008. Please read this by clicking here. Quote, Americans had over 200 concentration camps after World War II for German soldiers and people. So what is the origin of Zionism? Quote, as I show in my books, the campaign to impose a Rothschild fiefdom in Palestine goes back at least to the earlier part of the 19th century and probably long before. It was given a massive boost with the Balfour Declaration in 1917 when the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, declared in a letter his government's support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This letter was sent by Balfour, an inner circle member of an elite secret society called the Round Table, to Baron Walter Rothschild, who funded the Round Table. Today, Rothschild Illuminati fronts like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and others still answer to the Round Table, which string pulls and coordinates from the shadows. This is why Zionists in government are invariably connected with these Rothschild-controlled organizations. The Rothschilds funded the early settlers from Europe to relocate in post-war Palestine, and they also funded and armed the terrorist groups like Irgun, which bombed and terrorized Israel into existence in 1948. A campaign which forced 800,000 Palestinians to leave the land of their birth. Israel is simply the state of Rothschild, and how appropriate that they, Rothschilds, paid for the construction of the Israeli Parliament building, the Knesset, and the Israel Supreme Court. The name Rothschild means red shield, and it originates with the red shield star of David symbol, not a Jewish symbol before the Rothschilds, which they displayed on their house in Frankfurt. The very flag of Israel tells you who owns it. There are many reasons why the Rothschilds and their allies wanted to hijack Palestine, and one was to keep the Middle East in a state of disruption and turmoil from which a global war can eventually be triggered to usher in the new world order of world government dictatorship. David Icke, from his essay, The Zionist Elephant in the Room, June 14, 2009. And yes, the New World Order is a term uttered thousands of times by all U.S. presidents, including Obama, whose real name, by the way, is Barry Sotoro. Do not let these terms, which have been downplayed and made to seem ridiculous in the Zionist-controlled media, stop you from comprehending the message of this writing. The New World Order is here, now. For proof of this, here is a great documentary, top on my list, in fact, that I highly recommend you watch after you read this, which will make your head absolutely spin. It's called Invisible Empire by Jason Burmis. Quote, "The last time I checked, Jews made up only 2% of the total U.S. population and only 1.2% of Canada's total population, barely 1% of France's population, and a mere 0.5 or 0.45% of the U.K. and Australian populations, respectively. And for a greater understanding, consider that of the 13 million Jews or so living on this planet, only 200,000 of them claim to be the Chabad Lubavitchers. So what of this Jewish supremacist movement, the Chabad? This racist, merciless group of men who clasp the hand of democratically elected Western leaders with their right hand, whilst their left hand launches deceptive telethons and charities in order to extract yet more money from U.S. citizens for Israel's continued slaughter of innocent women and children in Palestine. Is $6 billion per annum in U.S. taxpayer dollars not enough, O Israel?" Amalek, Radio Islam, Jewish Manipulation of the Non-Jewish Goy World Leaders. The Jewish Soap Myth. Zionist Jews have been spreading lies about soap being made from Jewish human remains since World War II. But several sources have disproved this myth, and it has never been proven. Begin excerpt. The owner of a Montreal collectibles shop is defending his decision to sell a bar of soap he advertises as being made of the fat of Holocaust victims. Jewish groups in Montreal are denouncing the shop in the city's Plateau Montreal neighborhood, where the beige bar of soap is displayed. The soap is inscribed with a swastika and displayed in a glass case with a card that says Poland, 1940. On Friday, Abraham Botinez, a Spanish-born Jew who has operated the Quirky Boutique since 1967, admitted he has no idea whether the soap is really made of human remains. Read more on this here. End excerpt. Quote, "A lab analysis of a swastika-stamped bar of soap said to be made from Holocaust victims shows no human remains. It's just a regular bar of soap," Montreal Police Inspector Paul Chevlot told the Canadian press. Jewish Journal, Montreal Police, Soap Not Made from Human Remains, June 3, 2010. Now, what needs to be understood about cases like these is that the myth and perpetual lie about the plight of the Jews in Nazi Germany will be carried on in the hearts of men, despite the fact that once again the myth was proven to be false. And besides, why would anyone want to take a bath with soap made from human remains? Come on, we have to think about these things logically here. Similar charges were found to be a hoax as well in World War I, and for the most part, Holocaust historians, both Jewish and otherwise, have had to gradually concede to the soap rumor as just a story. Also, for some strange reason, humans like to collect things like war memorabilia. Many collectors of the Nazi era have never run across human soap, and say begrudgingly that it is an urban legend. Now, who could have started a legend like that? The following is part of the Institute for Historical Review entitled Jewish Soap by Mark Weber. Begin excerpt. Quote, wartime rumors that the Germans were manufacturing soap from the corpses of slaughtered Jews were based in part on the fact that soap bars distributed by German authorities in Jewish ghettos and camps bore the impressed initials RIF, which many took to stand for Rein Jüdisches Fett, or Pure Jewish Fat. It did not seem to matter that the letters were RIF and not RJF. These rumors spread so widely in 1941 and 1942 that by late 1942, German authorities in Poland and Slovakia were expressing official concern about their impact. According to a Polish source quoted in a secret wartime U.S. Army military intelligence report, for example, the Germans were operating a human soap factory in 1941 at Turek, Poland. Quote, the Germans had brought thousands of Polish teachers, priests, and Jews there after extracting the blood serum from their bodies, had thrown them on large pots and melted off grease to make soap, the intelligence report added. Macabre Jewish soap jokes became popular in the ghettos and camps, and many non-Jews on the outside came to believe the story. When trains loaded with Jewish deportees stopped temporarily at rail stations, Poles reportedly would gleefully shout at them, Jews to soap. Even British prisoners of war interned at Auschwitz in 1944 testified later about the wartime rumors that corpses of gassing victims were being turned into soap there. In spite of its inherently incredible character, the soap story became an important feature of Jewish and Allied war propaganda. Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, wartime head of both the World Jewish Congress and the American Jewish Congress, publicly charged in November 1942 that Jewish corpses were being, quote, processed into such war-vital commodities as soap, fats, and fertilizer, unquote, by the Germans. He further announced that the Germans were, quote, even exhuming the dead for the value of the corpses and were paying 50 marks for each body. In late 1942, the Congress Weekly, published by the American Jewish Congress, editorialized that the Germans were turning Jews, quote, by scientific methods of dissolution into fertilizer, soap, and glue, unquote. An article in the same issue reported that Jewish deportees from France and Holland were being processed into soap, glue, and train oil in at least two special factories in Germany. Typical of many other American periodicals, the influential New Republic reported in early 1903 that the Germans were using the bodies of their Jewish victims to make soap and fertilizer in a factory at Zielk. During June and July of 1943, two prominent representatives of the Moscow-based Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee toured the United States and raised more than $2 million for the Soviet war effort at a series of mass meetings. At each of these rallies, Soviet Jewish leader Sullivan Michels showed the crowd a bar of soap that he said was made from Jewish corpses. In spite of all the apparently impressive evidence, the charge that the Germans manufactured soap from human beings is a falsehood, as Holocaust historians are now blatantly acknowledging. The RIF soap bar initials that supposedly stood for pure Jewish fat actually indicated nothing more sinister than Reich Center for Industrial Fat Provisioning, a German agency responsible for wartime production and distribution of soap and washing products. RIF soap was a poor quality substitute that contained no fat at all, human or otherwise. Shortly after the war, the Public Prosecutor's Office of Flensburg, Germany, began legal proceedings against Dr. Rudolf Spanner for his alleged role in producing human soap at the Danzig Institute. But after an investigation, the charge was quietly dropped. In a January 1968 letter, the office stated that its inquiry had determined that no soap from human corpses was made at the Danzig Institute during the war. More recently, Jewish historian Walter LeCour denied established history by acknowledging in his 1980 book, The Terrible Secret, that the human soap story has no basis in reality. Gita Sarini, another Jewish historian, noted in her book, Into That Darkness, quote, "The universally accepted story that corpses were used to make soap and fertilizer is finally refuted by the generally very reliable Ludwigsburg Central Authority for Investigation into Nazi Crimes." Deborah Lipstadt, a professor of modern Jewish history, similarly rewrote history when she confirmed in 1981, quote, "The fact is that the Nazis never used the bodies of Jews, or for that matter, anyone else, for the production of soap." In April 1990, Professor Yehunda Bauer of Israel's Hebrew University, regarded as a leading Holocaust historian, as well as Shmuel Krakowski, archives director of Israel's Yad Vashem Holocaust Center, confirmed that the human soap story is not true. Camp inmates, quote, "were prepared to believe any horror stories about their persecutors," Bauer said. At the same time, though, he had the chutzpah to blame the legend on the Nazis. In fact, blame for the soap story lies rather with the individuals such as Simon Wiesenthal and Stefan Wise. Organizations like the World Jewish Congress and the victorious Allied Powers, none of whom has ever apologized for promoting this vile falsehood. Why did Bauer and Krakowski decide that this was the appropriate time to officially abandon the soap story? Krakowski himself hints that a large part of the motivation for this tactical retreat has been to save what's left of the sinking Holocaust ship by throwing overboard the most obvious falsehoods. In the face of the growing revisionist challenge, easily demonstrable falsehoods like the soap story have become dangerous embarrassments because they raise doubts about the entire Holocaust legend. As Krakowski puts it, quote, "Historians have concluded that soap was not made from human fat. When so many people deny the Holocaust ever happened, why give them something to use against the truth?" Unquote. And now to the Diary of Anne Frank. Really? Here's an excerpt from The Anne Frank Diary Fraud by Brian Herring, tbrnews.org. Quote, "Propaganda, as a weapon of psychological warfare, is in even wider use today. Communists were masters of the art. Such has been the effect, if not the deliberate intention of many who have promoted its distribution, of a book of popular appeal, The Diary of Anne Frank. It has been sold to the public as the actual diary of a young Jewish girl who died in a Nazi concentration camp after 2 years of abuse and horror. Many Americans have read the book or seen the movie version and have been deeply moved by the real-life drama it claims to present. But have we been misled in the belief that Anne Frank actually wrote this diary? And if so, should an author be permitted to produce a work of fiction and sell it to the world as fact, particularly one of such tremendous emotional appeal, and which causes hate and political action in government?" The Swedish journal Frio Ord published two articles commenting on the Diary of Anne Frank. A condensation of these articles appeared in the April 15, 1959 issue of Economic Council Letter as follows. Quote, "History has many examples of myths that live a longer and richer life than truth, and may become more effective than truth. The Western world has for some years been made aware of a young Jewish girl through the medium of what purports to be her personally written story, Anne Frank's diary. Any informed literary inspection of this book has shown it to have been impossible as the work of a teenager. A noteworthy decision of the New York Supreme Court confirms this point of view, in that the well-known American writer Meir Levin has been awarded $50,000 to be paid him by the father of Anne Frank as an honorarium for Levin's work on the Anne Frank Diary. Mr. Frank, in Switzerland, had promised to pay the prominent Jewish author, Meir Levin, not less than $50,000 because he had used the literary creation of author Levin in toto and represented it to his publisher and to the public as his late daughter's original work. inquiry of the county clerk, New York County, as to the facts of the case referred to in the Swedish press brought a reply on April 23, 1962, giving the name of a New York firm of lawyers as attorneys for the respondent. Reference was to the diary of Anne Frank, 2203-58. A letter to this firm brought a response on May 4, 1962, that, although we represent Mr. Levin in other matters, we had nothing to do with the Anne Frank case. On May 7, 1962, came the following reply from a member of a firm of New York lawyers to whom the original inquiry had been forwarded. It was the attorney for Mayor Levin in his action against Otto Frank and others. It is true that a jury awarded Mr. Levin $50,000 in damages, as indicated in your letter. That award was later set aside by the trial justice, Honorable Samuel C. Coleman, on the ground that the damages had not been proved in the manner required by law. The action was subsequently settled between the litigating parties while an appeal from Judge Coleman's decision was pending. I'm afraid that the case itself is not officially reported, so far as the trial itself or even Judge Coleman's decision is concerned. Certain procedural matters were reported, both in 141 New York Supplement 2nd Series 170 and in 5-2nd Series 81. The correct file number in the New York County Clerk's Office is 2241-1956, and the file is probably a large and full one which must include Judge Coleman's decision. Unfortunately, our file is in storage and one cannot locate a copy of that decision as it appeared in the New York Law Journal early in the year 1960. Unquote. The diary of Anne Frank was first published in 1952 and immediately became a bestseller. It has been republished in paperback, 40 printings. It is impossible to estimate how many people have been touched and aroused by the movie production. Why has this trial involving the father of Anne Frank, bearing directly on the authenticity of this book, never been officially reported? In royalties alone, Otto Frank has profited richly from the sale of this book, purporting to depict the tragic life of his daughter. But is it fact or is it fiction? Is it truth or is it propaganda? Or is it a combination of all of these? And to what degree does it wrongfully appeal to the emotions through a misrepresentation as to its origin? School publications for years have recommended this book for young people, presenting it as the work of Anne Frank. Advertising in advance of the movie showing has played up the factual nature of the drama being presented. Do not writers of such editorials and promoters of such advertising fan the flames of hate they rightly profess to deplore? Many American Jews were shocked at the handling of the Eichmann case, the distortions contained in the book Exodus, and its movie counterpart. But their protests have had little publicity outside of their own organ, Issues by the American Council for Judaism. Others who have expressed the same convictions have been charged with anti-Semitism. So in other words, a proper lawful investigation cannot be conducted into the truthfulness of the Anne Frank diary because it would be considered Holocaust denial and anti-Semitic. Yet it is to be noted that both Otto Frank and his accuser, Mayor Levin, were Jewish, so a similar charge would hardly be applicable in pursuing this subject to an honest conclusion. File number 2241-1956 in the New York County Clerk's Office should be open to the public view and its content thoroughly publicized. Misrepresentation, exaggeration, and falsification has too often colored the judgment of good citizens. If Mr. Frank used the work of Mayor Levin to present to the world what we have been led to believe is the literary work of his daughter, wholly or in part, then the truth should be exposed. To label fiction as fact is never justified, nor should it be condoned. Since actual period documentation does not exist in support of the Holocaust myth, it has always been incumbent on its supporters to create it. Not only is the Anne Frank diary now considered to be a fake, so also is The Painted Bird by Jerry Kaczynski. This book, which is a mass of pornographic and sadistic imagery which, had it not been taken so seriously by the Jewish community, would be merely the pathetic manifestation of a self-serving and very sick person. This was duly exposed as a shabby, though much revered by the Jewish community, and quoted, fraud. When this was exposed, Kaczynski committed suicide. Later, in Kaczynski's footsteps, we find the next fiction entitled Fragments by a Swiss Protestant named Bruno Dossiker, who spent the war in Switzerland as a young child. Dossiker posed as a very young Baltic Jewish concentration camp inmate named Benjamin Wilkomirski. This work consists of allegedly fragmented memories and is very difficult to read. Dossiker became the poster boy for the Holocaust supporters and was lionized by the international Jewish community, reaping considerable profit and many in-house awards for his wonderful and moving portrayal of German brutality and sexual sadism. Another book, allegedly by a Hungarian doctor, concerning his deportation from Budapest in 1944 and subsequent journey by death train to Auschwitz, is another fraud. There was never such a doctor in Hungary during the period involved, and the alleged route of the train from Budapest to Auschwitz did not exist. Insofar as the Anne Frank diary is concerned, herewith is some background on Anne Frank, her family, and her alleged diary. The Franks were upper-class German Jews, both coming from wealthy families. Otto and his siblings lived on the exclusive Marienstrasse in Frankfurt. Otto attended a private prep school and also attended the Lessing Gymnasium, the most expensive school in Frankfurt. Otto attended Heidelberg University. After graduation, he left for a long vacation in England. In 1909, the 20-year-old Otto went to New York City, where he stayed with his relatives, the Oppenheimers. In 1925, Anne Frank's parents married and settled in Frankfurt, Germany. Anne was then born in 1929. The Franks' family business included banking, management of the springs at Bad Sodden, and the manufacture of cough drops. Anne's mother, the former Edith Hollander, was the daughter of a manufacturer. In 1934, Otto and his family moved to Amsterdam, where he bought a spice business, Opecta, which manufactures pectin used in making household jellies. On May 1940, after the Germans occupied Amsterdam, Otto remained in the city while his mother and brother moved to Switzerland. Otto remained in Amsterdam, where his firm did business with the German Wehrmacht. From 1933 to 1944, Otto sold Opecta and pectin to the German army. Now, pectin was a food preservative, an anti-infectant balm for wounds, and as a thickener for raising blood volume in blood transfusions. But pectin was also used as an emulsifier for petroleum, gelatized gasoline, for firebombing. By supplying the Wehrmacht, Otto Frank became, in the eyes of the Dutch, a Nazi collaborator. On July 6, 1942, Otto moved the Frank family to the so-called Secret Annex. The Annex is a three-story, mostly glass, townhouse that shares a garden park with 50 other apartments. While he was allegedly in hiding, Otto Frank still managed his business, going downstairs to his office at night and on weekends. Anne and the others would go to Otto's office and listen to radio broadcasts from England. The purported diary begins on June 12, 1942, and runs to December 5, 1942. It consists of a book that is 6x4x1/4 inches. In addition to this first diary, Anne supplemented it with personal letters. Otto said Anne heard Gerrit Bolkestein in a broadcast say, "Keep a diary," and he would publish it after the war. And that's why Anne's father claimed she rewrote her diaries a second time in 1944. In this second edition, the new writer changed, rearranged, and occasionally combined entries of various dates. When Anne allegedly rewrote the diaries, she used a ballpoint pen, which did not exist in 1945. And the book took on an extremely high literary standard and read more like a professional documentary than a child's diary. In Anne's second edition, her writing style and handwriting suddenly matured. The actual diary of Anne Frank contained only about 150 notes, according to the New York Times of October 2nd, 1955. In 1944, German authorities in occupied Holland determined that Otto Frank had been swindling then via his extensive and very lucrative Wehrmacht contracts. The German police then raided his apartment attic, and the 8 Jews were sent to Westerbork work camp and forced to perform manual labor. Otto himself was sent to Auschwitz. Anne, her sister Margot, and her mother subsequently died of typhus in another camp. Remember, Red Cross records showed that most deaths were of this typhus fever origin, and deaths in these work camps, not death camps, happened when supplies were cut off by Allied forces' bombing of railroads. In 1945, after being liberated from German custody, Otto returned to Amsterdam, where he claimed he found Anne's diary cleverly hidden in the annex's rafters. However, another version has a Dutch friend, Mype Geis, finding Anne's diary a fictional event, which she then gave to Otto Frank. Otto took what he claimed were Anne's letters and notes, edited them into a book which he then gave to his secretary, Isa Calvern, to review. Isa Calvern and her husband Albert Calvern, a writer, authored the first diary. Questions were raised by some publishers as to whether Isa and Albert Calvern, who assisted Otto in typing out the work, used the original diaries or whether they took it directly from Mr. Frank's personal transcription. American author Meyer Levin wrote the third and final edition. At the outset of World War II, Levin made documentary films for the U.S. Office of War Information and later worked in France as a civilian expert in the Psychological Warfare Division. End excerpt. Now, we must also note that after his Anne Frank writing, Levin went on to create other fictional movies about Jews in concentration camps, including Compulsion, Eva, The Fanatic, and The Stronghold. But at least these were dramatic fictions and not passed off as real-life documentary non-fiction, though that is the effect of fictional Holocaust propaganda films. So what do Jews think about the Goyim, or non-Jews? Quote, American Jews are actually being trained by Zionists since childhood to interact with non-Jews in a deceitful and arrogant manner, in coordination with each other, to emotionally destroy non-Jews and Israel critics, in addition to wrecking their careers and interfering with their social relationships. This is actually deliberate, wicked, planned behavior motivated by a narcissistic, self-righteous fury. The problem is that non-Jews are taught through emotional pressure and violence via the media and the school system to be very sensitive to Jewish suffering, so when a Zionist becomes outraged at them for challenging their worldview, the non-Jew really has to fight against his own inner self in a huge battle against his inner Jew, making him feel inadequate and intimidated. But the Jew doesn't care how much he or she hurts others. Jews only care about what's good for the Jews. I once reduced a 50-year-old man to hysterical sobbing tears because I told him gently and lovingly that Jews were not that unique. I just told him the Jews, like everyone else, have had good times and bad times, times when they were slaughtered and other times when they slaughtered others. Just like everyone else. Guess what he did next? He emotionally abused me in an insulting way and then cut off all further communication. Jewish behavior is so predictable that it's truly scary. If you mention cutting off the money, or if you mention the possible compromise of living with Palestinians as equals in one state, they become very angry and start using bullying tactics, unless they have some reason to fear you, in which case they shun you and complain about you to the authorities, try to get you arrested, or try to destroy your career or social status through character assassination. Zionists all believe in the myth of 1,000 years of Jewish suffering and feel the world owes them compensation for their ancestors' unique suffering. It's a criminally insane viewpoint. They cope with their contradictions between their belief that they are the good guys and what Jews are actually doing to their neighbors, both in the Middle East and in the United States, by developing mental health issues. Most Zionists are functional schizophrenics. Karen Friedman, an ethnically Jewish anti-Zionist blogger. Defining Jewish Eretz Yisrael, or Greater Israel. It is the dream of Zionist Jews, such as the Chabad, that Israel will one day extend from the Litani River in the north, i.e. Lebanon, to the River Nile in the south, i.e. Egypt, to the Euphrates in the west, i.e. Iraq. Quote, if Zionism today means Greater Israel, not only am I a post-Zionist, I am an anti-Zionist. If Zionism is the illegal settlements of Netzarim and Kiryat Arba, I am an anti-Zionist. I do not accept the type of Zionism that took Judaism with all its dazzling beauty and turned it into the worship of trees and stones. When I look around today, my feeling is that the Netzarim has become an altar. God has become a Moloch, an idol, and our children have become sacrifices, human sacrifices to terrible idol worship. Avraham Berg, former Jewish speaker of the Israel Parliament, the Knesset, the legislature of Israel. Quote, the United Nations General Assembly determines that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination, unquote. United Nations General Assembly Resolution number 3379, which was later revoked under massive Zionist pressure by Resolution number 4686. Just a few facts. 92% of all the land inside the Green Line of Israel is reserved for Jews only. The rest of the land, approximately 8%, is for the non-Jewish people who comprise 20% of the total Israeli population. Therefore, it is a segregated, apartheid country. This is further evidenced by the fact that there are Jews-only bypass roads that go to Jews-only settlements built on stolen Palestinian land. Non-Jews are never given permits to build inside of Israel. Quote, Judaism is not a religion. Judaism is not a race. Judaism is not a people. Judaism is a strategy. Judaism is the Jews' strategy to dominate non-Jews. Judaism is the ideology of the occupation, which is behind the occupation of Palestine. Judaism is the ideology and the strategy which is behind genocide and cruelties carried out by Jews in Palestine. The Palestinian people is today the most manifest victim of Judaism, the crime syndicate that calls itself a religion. Judaism is a declaration of war against us. But where are the real men in this country who are supposed to defend us? I dream of the day when there is no Israel. Israel exists for one purpose, which is to function as a hideout for those who live in the same state of perpetual war against everyone else that Judaism dictates. Mark Glenn, November 7, 2006, Judaism is Nobody's Friend. Quote, what emerged for me from the study of the first chapters of Sefer Haranya, the central works of the Chabad ultra-Orthodox organization, was the discovery that the mainstream of Jewish thought is permeated by genetic spiritual superiority of Jews over Gentiles, disconcertingly reminiscent of racist notions of our time. Living in Israel for the past 20 years, I have come to realize the vitality of Jewish racist notions. And I am more than ever convinced that the hold Judaism will have on this and future generations will be gravely impaired unless these notions are neutralized. Moshe Greenberg, biblical scholar and Jewish author, from his book, A Problematic Heritage, The Attitudes Towards the Gentile in the Jewish Tradition, An Israeli Perspective. Quote, my final, more general example is, if possible, even more shocking than the others. It concerns the attitude of the Hasidic movement, i.e. Orthodox Judaism, towards non-Jews. What, then, are the views of this movement concerning non-Jews? As an example, let us take the famous Hatanya fundamental book of the Chabad movement. According to this book, all non-Jews are totally satanic creatures, quote, in whom there is absolutely nothing good, unquote. Even a non-Jewish embryo is quantitatively different than a Jewish one. The very existence of a non-Jew is inessential, whereas all of creation was created solely for the sake of the Jews. Jewish professor Israel Shahak, from his extensively researched book, Jewish History, Jewish Religion, The Weight of 3,000 Years. quote, "We have to recognize that Jewish blood and the blood of the Goy are not the same thing," unquote. Rabbi Yitzchak Ginsburg, New York Times, June 6, 1989. Quote, "The difference between a Jewish soul and souls of non-Jews, all of them in all different levels, is greater and deeper than the difference between a human soul and the souls of cattle." Rabbi Kook, how fitting, the elder from the book Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel. Quote, "Even the best of the non-Jews should all be killed," unquote. Rabbi Simon ben Yahi, Talmud, Minor Tractates, Soferim 15, Rule 10. Quote, "1 million Arabs are not worth a Jewish fingernail," unquote. Rabbi Yaakov Perin, New York Daily News, February 28, 1994, page 6. Quote, "The difference between a Jewish and a non-Jewish person stems from the common expression, let us differentiate. Thus, we do not have a case of profound change in which a person is merely on a superior level. Rather, we have a case of let us differentiate between totally different species. This is what needs to be said about the body. The body of a Jewish person is of a totally different quality from the body of members of all nations of the world. A non-Jew's entire reality is only vanity. The entire creation of a non-Jew exists only for the sake of the Jews." Rabbi Menachem Shearson, quoted by Brownfield in the Washington Report of Middle East Affairs, March 2000, pages 105 through 106. Now here's an interesting one. Quote, "The genius of the Jews is to live off people, not off the land, nor off the production of commodities from raw materials, but off people. Let other people till the soil, the Jew, if he can, will live off the tiller. Let other people toil at trades and manufacture, the Jew will exploit the fruits of their work. That is his particular genius. If this genius be described as parasitic, the term would seem to be justified. The Jewish nation is the only nation that possesses the secrets of all the rest. There is no government in the world so completely at their service as America. The British did this. The Germans did that, when it was the international Jew who actually did it. The Americans are now known as a sordid, greedy, cruel people. Why? Because Jewish money power is centered here." Now that was from Henry Ford of the Ford Motor Company, an American icon and creator of the assembly line, and he authored his own book, The International Jew, from which this quote was taken. I found that amazing. Quote, "When a Jew in America or in South Africa talks to his Jewish companions about our government, he means the government of Israel," unquote. David Ben-Gurion, Israeli Prime Minister. Quote, "There is little outward anti-Semitism of the kind one sees in the Western world. It's a much warmer society than one imagines from the outside." Jewish Magazine on Iran's culture. Quote, "But would the world permit such ethnic cleansing? That depends on who does it and how quickly it happens. We possess several hundred atomic warheads and rockets and can launch them at targets in all directions, perhaps even at Rome. Most European capitals are targets for our air force. Let me quote General Moshe Dayan. Quote, Israel must be like a mad dog, too dangerous to bother," unquote. "We shall try to prevent things from coming to that if at all possible. We have the capability to take the world down with us, and I can assure you that that will happen before Israel goes under." Israeli professor Martin Van Creveld, whom advocates the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and suggests that Israel should use nuclear blackmail to commit ethnic crimes. Quote, "I believe they feel a sense of outrage against the United States. They identify with the Palestinian problem, they identify with people who oppose repressive regimes, and I believe then to focus their anger on the United States." James Fitzgerald, FBI special agent, testifying at the 9/11 Commission public hearing, referring to the terrorists whom attacked the United States. This testimony was not included in the 9/11 Commission's report. Quote, By his own account, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's animus toward the United States stemmed not from his experiences there as a student, but rather from his violent disagreement with U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel. Page 147 of the 9/11 Commission Report. A quick word on the Talmud and Protocols of Zion. I won't get into this here, though the Protocols of Zion are like a playbook and instruction manual on how to subvert, demoralize, and take control of a society. And the Talmud is the book used in lieu of the Torah for the ungodly Zionist Jews regarding the treatment of and death wish for non-Jews. Instead, I have included a link to this wonderfully put together video in 12 parts set to autoplay on YouTube called The Khazarian Conspiracy. Consider these books the Bibles of Zionism. I highly recommend this video for a deeper understanding of where the Zionist hatred of all non-Jews and the synagogue of Satan stems from. And then we get to the Christian-Israeli alliance. What the f... Should Christians really support Israel? Zionist Israeli Jews have led the fight against prayer in school, to ban Christmas carols in school, to ban Christian symbols on public land, and even at the White House, while Jewish menorahs and other Jewish symbols hang freely. Again, a result of less than 2% of the population defiling the majority. Zionists have led the fight for abortion, for radical feminism, for homosexual marriage, and all but have a monopoly on the porn industry. And most Christians don't know that around 30% of Palestinians are indeed Christian and are being harassed, beaten, imprisoned, made homeless, bombed, maimed, and killed for simply being Palestinian and or Christian. Israel Anti-Christian Law 5738-1977 equals 5 years in prison for witnessing for Christ. Israeli law. Quote, the Israeli government is anti-Christian, unquote. Archbishop Manoujian. Quote, Christian clergy spit upon daily in Jerusalem. Headline from Haaretz, a Jewish newspaper. Quote, wearing a dark blue robe, sitting in St. James Church, a Goyan said, every single priest in this church has been spat on. It happens day and night. Jerusalem Post. Note that nuns are spat on as well, and that beating or killing women and children have no moral limitations as compared to men. The percentage of deaths for Palestinians is about 50% men and 50% women and children. The following is taken from a recorded phone conversation between the Reverend Billy Graham and then President Richard Nixon. Nixon. Wasn't that a horrible thing, those Israelis shooting down that plane, another terrorist attack, this time killing over 100? I mean, to shoot down an unarmed 707, good heavens, that's worse than what they did at the Olympics on the other side. Yes, another Israeli terrorist attack. Graham. Well, you see, there's two other points. One is the front page of papers over the weekend carried the story that they're talking about expelling all Christians from Israel. Nixon. Oh, isn't that nice. Graham. And the second point is that the Jews in this country are just raising a big... and they are damning Campus Crusade and damning so forth. They are going right after the church, and there's a great deal of feeling beginning to rise. Nixon. It happened in Spain, it's happened in Germany, it's happening... and now it's going to happen in America if these people, Jews, don't start behaving. Graham. Well, you know, I told you one time that the Bible talks about two kinds of Jews. One is called the synagogue of Satan. They're the ones putting out the pornographic literature. They're the ones putting out these obscene films. Nixon, like the one in Time magazine and then Newsweek? Graham, it's terrible. Ruth canceled them both. Nixon, good for her, but Graham, we won't take Time or Newsweek. Nixon, I'll tell you, this group, I think really they don't deserve to live. Newsweek is totally... it's all run by Jews and dominated by them in their editorial pages. The New York Times, the Washington Post, totally Jewish too. Graham, this stranglehold has got to be broken or this country is going to go down the drain. Nixon, do you believe that? Graham, yes, sir. Nixon, I can't ever say it, but I believe it. Quote, I went to a Jewish meeting and said that I would crawl to beg forgiveness. Billy Graham in order to save his ministry to the anti-Christian Zionist Jews after the above conversation was made public. Quote, "A church can become dysfunctional because a psychopath gains control, and it's not always the pastor. Soon the whole church goes insane." Tex Mars, author from The Rise of the Illuminati, Psychopaths, and the Savage Horror of America's Coming Gloom. Quote, "Christian churches are going Jew, and their pastors demand to be called rabbi. Their people are wearing Jewish garments and are into Yiddish songs and dancing in a circle. Meanwhile, some are working on a Christian Talmud, a book of laws and traditions for all Christians to obey." Tex Mars, author, quoted from his website, texmars.com. Quote, "If we Christians hated the Jews, we wouldn't want to see them in heaven with us, would we? We'd want to see them go to hell. But it's the Christian who truly loves the Jews, who truly wants the best for them. And that's why we preach to the Jews as well as to Gentiles." Tex Mars, author from his video, Thunder Over Zion. His point being that this is a huge difference between the use of the word goyim by Zionist Jews to describe non-Jews or Gentiles as cattle without a soul. And now a few quotes from the Bible. "I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan." Revelation 2:9. "His blood be on us and our children." Matthew 27:25, depicting Jews yelling about crucifying Jesus. "And no man spoke of him for fear of the Jews." John 7:13, referring to Jews killing Christians. "For you suffered as your own countrymen did from the Jews, who killed both the Lord Jesus and the prophets, and drove us out, and displease God and oppose all mankind, who keep us from speaking to the Gentiles that they might be saved. But God's wrath has come upon them at last." Thessalonians 2:14-16. Quote, "What exactly is so scandalous about the Talmud? How about Jesus punished in hell for eternity by being made to sit in a cauldron of boiling excrement?" Publishers Weekly, referring to the Talmud. Quote, "Good. I hope the Jews did kill Christ. I'd do it again. I'd fucking do it again in a second." Sarah Silverman, Jewish Zionist comedian, in a stand-up routine. Quote, "The only reason that Jews are in pornography is that we think that Christ sucks." Jewish Zionist Al Goldstein, publisher of Screw magazine. Quote, "Pornography thus becomes a way of defiling Christian culture. Porn kings are motivated by a Jewish atavistic hatred of Christian authority. They are trying to weaken the dominant culture in America by moral subversion." Jewish Zionist professor Nathan Abrams in the Jewish Intellectual Quarterly, bragging about the Jewish domination of the porn industry. So do Jews really own the media and run Hollywood? Quote, "Four of the largest five entertainment giants are now run or owned by Jews. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is the only Gentile non-Jew holdout. However, Rupert is as pro-Israel as any Jew, probably more so." The Los Angeles Jewish Times, October 29, 1999. Also, Murdoch's News Corp has Jewish Zionist Peter Chernin as its president and CEO. All of these companies were started originally by Gentiles and infiltrated incrementally by Rothschild's Zionists. Quote, "The Jews control Hollywood. So what?" Cover of Moment, the Jewish magazine for the 90s, August 1996 edition, authored by Zionist Jew Michael Medved. Quote, "It makes no sense at all to try to deny the reality of Jewish power and prominence in popular culture. Any list of the most influential production executives at each of the recognizably Jewish studios will produce a heavy majority of recognizably Jewish names. The famous Disney organization, which was founded by Walt Disney, a Gentile Midwesterner who allegedly harbored anti-Semitic attitudes, now features Jewish personnel in nearly all its most powerful positions. Men and women of Jewish background enjoy a vastly disproportionate, if not dominant, influence in Hollywood." In fact, even studios which were bought out by the Japanese Sony Corporation and by Australian Jew Rupert Murdoch still had to hire a Jewish team of long-time industry leaders in all the most powerful positions. When Mitsushita took over MCA Universal, they did nothing to undermine the unquestioned authority of Universal's legendary and all-Jewish management triad of Lou Wasserman, Sid Sheinberg, and Tom Pollock. Medved further writes that most of today's movie moguls graduated from Ivy League colleges, quote, where Jews are vastly overrepresented, just as they are in Hollywood, unquote. For instance, Jewish students equal about 23% of students at Harvard University, equal to the number of whites. Remember, we are talking about less than 2% of the population here compared to 75%. Continued, quote, poll after poll taken over the past 10 years shows that the public believes this industry is more firmly associated with Jews than any other business in the world. That it is almost universally viewed as a destructive force in our society should be of concern. The combined weight of so many Jews in one of America's most lucrative and important industries gives the Jews of Hollywood a great deal of political power. They are a major source of money for Democratic candidates. The industry's informal patriarch, MCA Chairman Lou Wasserman, wields tremendous personal clout in state and national politics. So do Barbara Streisand, Norman Lear, and others. That was from Jewish Zionist Michael Medvev, from Moment, August 1996 edition. Quote, Hollywood is run by Jews. It is owned by Jews. The Jews have slandered every other racial group, but are ever so careful to ensure that there is never any negative image of the Kike. That was Marlon Brando on the Larry King Live Show, April 5, 1996, to Larry King. For this, Marlon Brando was labeled anti-Semitic and forced to apologize to the Jews running the Simon Wiesenthal Holocaust Tourist Center in Los Angeles. Quote, it just shows how dumb America has gotten. Jews totally run Hollywood. Zionist Jew Joel Stein in the Los Angeles Times opinion section, How Jewish is Hollywood? Continued, quote, I don't care if America thinks we're running the news media, Hollywood, Wall Street, or the government. I just care that we get to keep running them. How deeply Jewish is Hollywood? When the studio chiefs took out a full-page ad in the Los Angeles Times a few weeks ago to demand that the Screen Actors Guild settle its contract, the open letter was signed by the Alliance of Motion Picture Television Producers, which included Peter Chernin, Jewish Zionist, Chairman and CEO of the Fox Group, Brad Gray, Jewish Zionist, Chairman and CEO of the Paramount Pictures Corporation, Robert A. Iger, Jewish Zionist, President and CEO of the Walt Disney Company, Michael Linton, Dutch Jewish Zionist, Chairman and CEO of Sony Pictures Entertainment, Barry M. Mayer, Jewish Zionist, Chairman and CEO of Warner Brothers, Leslie Moonves, Jewish Zionist whose great-uncle was the first Prime Minister of Israel, Chairman and CEO of CBS Corporation, Harry Sloan, Jewish Zionist, Chairman and CEO of MGM, and Jeff Zucker, Jewish Zionist, President and CEO of NBC Universal.